Okay, folks, we're going to go ahead and get started here. If you want to find yourself a seat. Well, good evening. My name is Rob Miller, and I'm currently chairing the Pomo Mesa Management Area Technical Group. And we're so glad you could come tonight. Perhaps by show of hands, just so our panelists can see, how many of you have attended one of these meetings in previous years? Okay, well, for those of you who haven't, we are going to start back at the beginning to make sure that you have a little history and context. And for those that have, please be patient with us as we go through that. We wanted to start by discussing the purpose for tonight. We're here to discuss our annual report that we released just this summer for the year 2010. It might seem a little strange that we're talking about 2010 when we're very well into 2011, but that's how our process and our cycle works. Not that we can't talk about 2011, but our focus will certainly be on last year. We wanted to start with a little introduction so you knew some of the folks who were sitting before you. We have a couple of panelists who were not able to attend tonight, but we do have a good group. Again, I'm Robert Miller, representing the Woodlands Mutual Water Company and chairing the technical group. Steve Bachman couldn't be here tonight. One of our experts from ConocoPhillips, a lot of groundwater experience. We have Brad Newton, who's working with the Pomo Community Services District. We have Norm Brown, representing ConocoPhillips, Tim Cleet, also with the Woodlands Mutual Water Company. Toby Moore is one of our Golden State representatives who couldn't be here tonight. Tim Peterson will be representing Golden State Water Company. And then Jacqueline Frederick, those of you who know Jackie from her column and local community service, she also couldn't be here this evening. She's our agricultural representative. We'll talk a little bit more about what that means in a bit. Well, let's start with the map. Many of you know that Santa Maria Groundwater Basin was, for the purpose of the court analysis, broken up into a number of areas. And tonight we're going to be focused on the Pomo Mesa Management Area, a sub-area of a larger groundwater basin. There's also the Northern Cities area to our north that serves the Five Cities area, and then the main Santa Maria Groundwater Basin to our south, basically south of the river. Zooming in on our area, you will see that there's a number of different purveyors, and if you catch the legend there, you can see the different service areas, really represented by a lot of people at this table. NCSD, the Community Services District, the Woodlands Mutual Water Company, and then Rural Water Company, and also Golden State Water Company. So, see a wide cross-section of the pumpers from this basin are represented here tonight. Well, what's the purpose and history of our technical group? It started with, unfortunately, litigation. Many of you who are sitting here today were involved in that, and that went on for a number of years, almost 10 years, a whole decade, until finally a number of parties agreed to a settlement, which we call the stipulation. So you're going to hear that word probably batted around a lot, particularly during question and answer. And that stipulation was basically an agreement among any of the parties to certain actions. One of those actions was the formation of a technical group comprised of water and groundwater experts to look at conditions within the basin, primarily to analyze, to monitor, and to report. This is not the group who will be taking a lot of physical actions. Those actions get taken by the purveyors and other parties. But this is the group that's going to look at the conditions and recommend to the community at large, to the court, certain actions. So the representatives on the technical group, you've heard this a little bit in introductions, but they're these players that you see on your screen, Golden State, ConocoPhillips, also a key producer from the basin and has representation on the technical group, the Pomo Community Services District, the Woodlands, and then there's an ag representative on the group. Rural Water Company, for those of you who are in rural service area, they do attend a lot of the meetings, but they don't have a formal representative on the technical group. So you may hear a bit about the technical group meetings. They are a court-appointed series of meetings, and they can be attended by any stipulating party. So those of you who may not be stipulating parties know that you can't attend those meetings. But the work products that come out of our process do get released to the public. They're released through the court process. So at the end, we'll show you a website link where you can get some of the documents that are talked about here tonight, and those are all accessible through the court. So what are the key objectives of this group? Well, monitoring is probably one of our most important objectives. You think, well, monitoring, not very exciting, right? But to have all of the information that's important to analyze the health of the basin in one area, in one group, consistently monitored, is a very important step to coming to good, sound conclusions on the health of the basin. We report annually on the conditions of the basin, and those are summarized in a report, which is really the purpose of our meeting tonight. This is the third time that we've done this. Every time we release a report, we have a public meeting. So this is a summary of our third annual report. And then we want to identify conditions that would require corrective actions. Again, we're not the group that takes those actions, but we're going to highlight those conditions that require correction. You're going to hear about exactly what that means. We really try to define that so that we know when we've reached those critical points. A lot of this may be an old hat for many of you because you own your own wells or you've been around water systems for quite some time. But for those of you who haven't, just a brief discussion of the background here. So groundwater currently is the sole source of water for the Napomo area. Many other urban areas have surface water supplies. We don't. Groundwater is our source of water. And that water is stored in the pores of the soil in the ground, these water-bearing pores, and then extracted through wells. And we know that one of the things we use to analyze the movement of water is this basic principle that water moves from areas of high pressure to areas of low pressure, or high elevation to low elevation. And you'll see some of the maps that we produce that reflect that as we try to understand how water can move within the basin. A couple of terms you may see batted around tonight, and actually if we end up going too far into our lingo, feel free to stop us and ask for clarification. It's very easy for us to do. Aquitard is basically a wet clay layer or a confining layer that prevents the movement of water, almost like a liner that you have in the bottom of a pool. They're not perfectly watertight necessarily, but they do provide a barrier to water when you can pass them. That's an aquifer. A basin or an aquifer is basically defined as almost like a bowl full of sand. It's this area where water can store, and that water is stored within the spaces between the sand particles. And here you'll see a theoretical picture of what a well looks like. It's basically a hole in the ground meant to keep access open to those deeper layers in the ground so that we can pump water. Pump this place down the hole, we produce water. So this is a very simplified version of what a groundwater basin is. But one of the things we wanted to show you, not that we'll talk about this in detail, you'll hear a lot of discussion about uncertainty tonight. We are unable to characterize all the conditions within our groundwater basin because of many uncertainties. And this map is one example of a cross-section. If you were to split the ground, what it might look like. And really, it's a complex series of layers that allow movement of water, layers that restrict movement of water, and those can be quite complex to show in this Department of Water Resources slide. And so when we talk about uncertainty, we mean we have conditions under the ground that we're not able to fully characterize because we just don't have enough information to do that. Talking a little bit about groundwater measurements. Now, we don't measure groundwater conditions continuously in most cases. In some wells, we do. But for the most part, we have semi-annual water level measurements that are made by the county. And so when we talk about conditions, we mean what we see twice a year. So you might think, well, what's happening this summer? Well, we don't necessarily know because we take a reading in the fall and a reading in the spring, and we draw our conclusions based on those readings. For water quality, we primarily rely on the samples that are taken from wells that water purveyors own, because purveyors are often required to sample their wells before they serve the water to their customers. So again, all the wells you see on some of our maps, they're not all sampled for water quality. We'd love it if they were, but they're not. So some of the conclusions that we reach, we're basing on a limited number of samples. Our goal is always to reduce uncertainty. So we're constantly talking about protocol. How do we take that well measurement? What procedures do we use? What labs do we use to measure water quality? We're seeking ways to reduce our uncertainties. Seawater intrusion. That word itself certainly gets people on the edge of their seats. And one of the core mandates of this group is to look for conditions that could be either evidence of seawater intrusion or a precursor to it. So it's important that we define it. What we mean by seawater intrusion is the movement of salt water into a freshwater aquifer. That simple. Salt water itself is actually denser than fresh water. So even if you have the sea here and an aquifer here, both at the same level, we know based on the density of seawater that it will move in unless you have a constant flow of fresh water out to the ocean. We'll hear about that tonight. So again, this is one of our key objectives, to prevent this from occurring, because once it does occur, it's very difficult to reverse. Not impossible. There are examples in California where it has been reversed, but we know from local examples that it can be very difficult. So our groundwater aquifer includes a lot of pumpers that are fairly near the coast, and that aquifer does extend offshore. So in the event that water levels drop to a certain degree, we will have conditions that would allow seawater intrusion. So what causes it? In general, overpumping is the primary cause, the key cause of seawater intrusion. Currently, there is no evidence of seawater intrusion within the Como Basin Management Area. And we'll talk about specifically why we come to that conclusion and what that means. That doesn't mean there aren't conditions to be concerned about. It just means that we don't see any evidence right now of current seawater intrusion. So if you haven't really heard anything so far, this is the point where you're really going to want to perk up. This is a discussion of how the technical group has decided to characterize our groundwater basin by measuring certain physical conditions that become a very important set of triggers that identify how the basin as a whole is doing. So this is a very important part to understand. We have two sets of monitoring wells, or wells that we're very interested in, that we use to define conditions within this basin. And we use them, as you'll hear in a second, to define some of our key triggers as to when actions need to occur. And these are those wells. Firstly, the sentinel wells. We call them that because they're the first line of defense with seawater intrusion. And those are located near the coast. There's a number of sentinel wells that are not only in our area, but also in the Northern Cities area, the Santa Maria area. But these are the key sentinel wells that we are watching vigilantly to look for any evidence of seawater intrusion. And then in the inland areas, we have what we call our key wells. As you can see, they're distributed relatively uniformly throughout the area. And these wells often have a long history attached to them, so that we can look back decades and see how water levels have responded through various drought cycles. One of the very key elements of selecting one of these wells for our key well monitoring. And so we use these wells as part of the process of identifying triggers. Let's talk about what those are. All of the information I'm going to present right now is summarized in an appendix to our annual report, and you can see that on our web link, which is in Appendix B, I believe. Very important documents to familiarize yourself with if you're interested in groundwater and FOMO. So first, let's talk about coastal wells, and we'll discuss water conditions that we have defined as being of a concern that's needing to trigger actions. So first, our coastal wells will be the first places where we detect seawater intrusion at the coast, and the key wells would be used to identify inland water quality and inland conditions. So we're going to talk a little bit about water shortage conditions, and what we're doing is we're taking the stipulation, that court-mandated judgment that any of the parties agreed to, and we are identifying specific conditions that the stipulation required us to identify. The court said, look, here's two conditions that you have to define, and we've done that. They're summarized in Appendix B. So there's two water shortage conditions that the court mandated. The first is that we identify a potentially severe water shortage condition, and the second is a severe water shortage condition. And these, as you can imagine, with the lawyers involved, have some very specific definitions. First, potentially severe. So this is designated to reflect that water levels beneath the NMMA as a whole are at a point which we need to implement some voluntary measures. And we usually say this is analogous to, if you look at a traffic signal, to a yellow light, where there's some conditions that would concern us, and that some voluntary measures need to be put in place, where we would either employ water conservation, augment our water supplies, or other steps to prevent the water levels from declining any further. So the yellow light goes on, and we have to look at voluntary measures. So we've defined those as follows. Within our coastal wells, in those sentinel wells, we define a potentially severe water shortage condition as anything that doesn't fall below safe water levels where you would not be able to have the potential for seawater intrusion. Said another way, in order for seawater intrusion to occur, water levels at the coast have to drop down sufficiently in order to allow that seawater to flow in. Because seawater is more dense than fresh water, it's not enough just to have water levels at sea level. They need to be above sea level to prevent the migration of seawater intrusion. We also define it in terms of water quality. If we do see water quality conditions that indicate seawater intrusion is either coming or may come, it's one of the things we need to be concerned about as a potentially severe water shortage condition. So chlorides are what we look at, one of the constituents of seawater, obviously, and if they get to a 250 milligram per liter threshold, we identify that as a potentially severe trigger. So we don't just look at the coastal wells, we also look at the inland wells, and what we've done is we've produced an index, which is basically a summary, a numerical summary, of all the key wells which we showed you here a few minutes ago. And we use that index, and we track it year after year, in order to identify thresholds that we've shown as being a water shortage condition threshold. And we'll show you a map of that in a second. A severe water shortage condition, again, is a court definition. This is pulled right from that court document. At the lowest historical water levels beneath the NMMA as a whole, have reached basically conditions that seawater intrusion, as a whole, have been reached, or that conditions constituting seawater intrusion have been reached. So basically, we found that historical water levels, the lowest historical water levels that we have on record, have been reached, and or we have some sort of an active indication of seawater intrusion. That is our red light, a severe water shortage condition. So we define that as follows. In terms of coastal water quality, if chlorides get to a level at 500 milligrams per liter where they hit the drinking water standard, That's the maximum recommended drinking water standard for fluoride. So anything above that would trigger that severe water shortage condition. And then for our inland wells, at 16.5 feet above sea level, we define that as being the historic low for our inland wells, and you'll see this on a map here. Very important figure, and you'll see this reproduced in each of our annual reports as we track year to year. You can see that we go all the way back to 1975, which is certainly through a number of drought cycles, in order to assess this index. And so you'll see with the top line is your potentially severe water shortage condition. So as soon as we drop below that top line, the top horizontal dashed line, we say that we're within a potentially severe condition. Now, a couple of things that you'll note right away. One is that we've been in that condition a number of times before in history. Essentially, when we go through a drought cycle, we would expect that we would be within that condition. And we certainly hit that in the 90s. You'll also notice that as you look at the far edge of that chart, that we're in it currently. We're in a potentially severe water shortage condition. The horizontal line below that dashed line is severe water shortage condition. We have not hit that historically based on all the records that we have. And so that's the threshold where we say, if it drops to this, we've reached the low of our historical lows, and the red light goes on, and we reach a severe water shortage condition. So that's some of the background and the tools that we use to analyze the health of the basin. So what did we find in 2010? Well, number one, we are within a potentially severe water shortage based on our key well index. So we looked at those inland wells, we plotted that index and found that yes, we're within a potentially severe water shortage. Spring water levels have declined for the past number of years, and only slightly increased because of the good rainfall we had in 2010. Very important statement, that third bullet, that additional technical work is needed to further define our groundwater aquifer geology. Many of you, I think, probably, or some of you at least, came to this meeting hoping that all of us would be able to tell you, here's exactly how much water we can pump. Here's exactly how much time we have before a seawater intrusion could be a problem, and come up with definitive numbers that we could use for planning. But because of the complexity of this basin, we can't always give you those defined numbers. But what we can do is track real conditions in the basin and set these triggers after which we need to take actions. So we do have some uncertainty that prevents us from making strong statements of certain numerical quantities. Total estimated groundwater production from our basin, a little over 10,000 acre feet within our management area. And you can see that broken out in detail in our annual report. It's dropped off a little bit from last year, primarily because of the increased rainfall we believe. The next two maps are an example of a very important work product that all the technical groups, both Santa Maria and Northern Cities, also do this. And that is the groundwater contour map. You may not be familiar with this type of map, but basically those blue lines with the numeric elevation represent the distance from sea level to the water level that's inside the well. So basically we survey the top of the well and we measure down to groundwater. We plot these lines which represent the absolute elevation above sea level within our groundwater basin. One of the features that you can see here is going to be a little bit more pronounced in the next slide. This particular slide reflects the spring water levels in 2010. We're going to show you another slide that reflects the fall water levels, which, as you can imagine, are somewhat deeper because it hasn't rained throughout the summer. Some of the things that we as groundwater experts get concerned about is where pumping occurs, sometimes we have what's called a pumping depression. I'll go ahead and turn that on here. And when you have a lot of production out of one area within a basin, if the water can't flow back into that area quickly enough to bring water levels back up, you'll have basically a hole or a pumping depression where water levels stay depressed for a long period of time. And this is what we call the main pumping depression there in brown, where many of the purveyors have their production wells. You also see in yellow an area which we sometimes call the saddle, but we'll bore you with the details. But it's an area that basically separates the Nakoma Mesa area from the Northern Cities area. And this is one zone because it could be important from the perspective of seawater intrusion that we're watching very closely. We want water conditions always to be moving fresh water towards the ocean, not the other way around. So that's an area where we're watching very closely for conditions that may concern us. This is a very busy map that basically reflects over time the water levels that are within our coastal or sentinel monitoring wells. And basically what this slide is intended to show is that we have fairly stable water levels at the coast. They basically follow a repeating cycle that stay within a defined range over many, many years. One of our charges is to come up with recommendations for future years, and we've done that in this annual report. We've broken up those recommendations into three categories: technical, a list of our achievements, and then funding recommendations. So first, technical recommendations. Basically that pumping depression that you saw a few slides ago, in part because of that, and also because of declining water levels, one of our recommendations is to implement a supplemental water project as soon as possible. We also have a detailed work plan, which I won't go through each item, but it basically reflects the technical work products that we want to accomplish within the next year. We have a well management plan drafted. We want to revisit that, report out on that year to year. From time to time, we want to make changes in our monitoring processes and in our monitoring points or methods. We want to install, to the extent that we can, modern equipment within key wells in order to continuously monitor the water levels in those wells. And then for any well that we consider to be important, we want to make sure we have a real ground survey of the top of that well, and not just going to Google Earth and hovering over it, as I know many of you have done, but actually a real ground survey so we have a very tight elevation of that well. Defining groundwater production is quite difficult when you have a mix of producers other than just urban purveyors who have to measure and report their production. For agriculture, for private domestic pumpers, we have to make estimates of groundwater production. We want to continuously refine our methods for coming up with better numbers. Stream flow, all the streams within our area are an integral part of our groundwater basin because they form one source of recharge, so we're very interested in analyzing stream flow and keeping a good set of gauges where we can monitor that flow. Continuous collection of good weather data, very important. One of the good things about the technical group is that they're fairly vigilant. If they see data coming out of a monitoring station that doesn't look right, you know, maybe the sprinkler has got left on and got into the rain gauge, it'd be amazing how often that happens. We can catch those things based on other gauges in the area and talk to the gauge operator and say, this doesn't look right, you need to watch this gauge. And then, of course, continually review our criteria. Just because we say these are the triggers at this time, we've used it for 3 years, doesn't mean we can't, with new evidence, determine that new triggers need to be established. So we're always reviewing that information. So encouraging participation. This may be a time for audience participation at some point here, but we do want folks who have data on their groundwater production, particularly if you're an ag party or a private pumper. If you have data, we're very interested in using it. It'll be kept confidential, reported only in summary, and we try to send that message out, hoping that people would volunteer some data or allow us to have access to it. Very important for our understanding of the basin. Further defining the conditions that underlie our ground here, the hydrogeology, is an important mandate. Evaluating the costs and benefits of some significant future studies, the production of a groundwater model, This is an undertaking that will cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, but it's something that we think is worthwhile and something that we're targeting over time because it's such a useful tool in writing what-if scenarios and in assessing the health of our basin. Collaboration with other management areas. We try not to do these things in a vacuum. We have the Northern Cities, Santa Maria. We meet with them periodically to compare notes, try to stay on the same page where we can. So what have we done since our 2009 annual report? Well, certainly we've refined some of our production methodologies. You can see that in the report how we determined agricultural production, looking at land use, examining aerial imagery, coming up with methods that we think are very defensible for putting some numbers on our groundwater production. Part of that was determining what happens to the water after it's being used on plant material and to the rainfall as it hits our ground. Evaluating new or potential monitoring wells. One of our monitoring wells, I think you may hear about this more tonight, the Oso Flaco well has been buried in some 20 to 30 feet of sand. A number of officials have attempted to locate it so far without success. We have been successful in working with the County of San Luis Obispo to get a new monitoring well, and a number of new monitoring wells drilled, but we have not yet been able to replace this monitoring well. So one of our plans is to pursue funding, both through the member agencies that we represent and through other sources to replace this monitoring well. It's a very key well within our system. Continually evaluate hydrogeologic condition. Refine our understanding of these layers that confine groundwater movement, called confining layers, very important. And then evaluating subsurface conditions where water is flowing from one management area to another. Future goals, of course, we'll continue to produce an annual report. We are pursuing grant funding efforts. This is something that is continually on our radar screen. The state does have some groundwater assistance grant funding that comes up from time to time. You can bet that we'll be applying for that, pursuing it vigorously. The county sometimes has funding available through their integrated water plans. We will pursue that. So it's not just these parties and the customers of our service areas contributing to our funding, but we're pursuing grants. Again, confining layer definition, looking at flow across our boundaries, surveying wellheads where we need more information, conducting analytical testing of water quality. Ultimately, all of this work will consummate in a groundwater model. Now, it's not the end-all. Once you have a model, it doesn't tell you everything. It's still just a computer model. But it's a very good tool for defining how much water can be pumped and what happens when you pump from various areas in the basin. Replace the Oso Flaco monitoring well. Install automated equipment in order to monitor our wells. This is a website where you can access all of our annual reports. So if you have an interest in having these slides, come see myself or Lonnie before afterwards, sitting there at the front, and Lonnie, and we can get you a copy of these slides electronically. Give us your email, we'll send it to you, so you'll have that website link and you can download those documents if you're interested. So what we'd like to do now is, maybe we can turn on some lights so you panelists can actually see their faces. We're a pretty small group here tonight, and I know a number of you are pretty highly familiar with the subject material. So what we'd like to do is we're recording this, so I know it's easier to stay where you are and answer questions, but I think it's worth, if you can bear with us, getting up out of your seat and coming to the microphone there just so we can have it recorded for posterity and ask your question. And then I will probably parcel it out and let each of the panelists who want to comment on it go ahead and take their best shot at answering it. So now is a great time. And just to encourage you, I know many of you I think are probably involved in water is always a controversial issue. We're trying to keep this very technical tonight. So I encourage you to keep your questions to questions and try to minimize the statements. So please join us. Oh, state your name so we can know.
My name's Carla Haney. I'm a rural water user. And I'm just curious, why does Rural Water not have a representative with the group?
You know, within, and I'll let others speak to this also, perhaps there are some lawyers who were here when the stipulation went through. But as part of the court proceedings, the parties agreed to a certain makeup of the technical group in court, got hardwired into the stipulation, and they didn't make the cut.
Okay. That's not my real question. I have kind of a two-part. In a yes or no answer, has the NMMATG ever seen the credible evidence of seawater intrusion that could affect the water supply on the Napomo Mesa? And part B, if the answer to part A is yes, then please explain how long before it gets to our production wells and what can be done about it.
What a great question. I'll let everybody ponder for a minute so they can answer that. I think I'll make an attempt at a first answer here. Please please amplify. Within our, I'll answer that. You asked for a yes or no question. I'll say no. Within our Napomo Mesa management area, our defined area, there's been no evidence of seawater intrusion. Now, within other management areas, Northern Cities, one of their annual reports spoke to an event where there was a concern about seawater intrusion, but not within our core management area. Of course, we're trying to keep our eyes on our boundaries as well, and so that was a cause for concern for us, but it did not affect our management area. And then I think there was a question of how long. I would love it if some of you who have experienced seawater intrusion in other basins could answer that. If you want to start.
Okay. Seawater intrusion doesn't move very rapidly, but it has continuous movement in response to the pressure conditions within the different aquifers. For instance, in the Los Osos area, we see that it's moving several hundred feet a year coming inland. And that's potentially what could happen if water levels dropped sufficient so that we have that onward movement onshore. When that will happen, it all depends on the amount of the gradient inland which the seawater can move. But we don't totally understand what's offshore in terms of the extent of the freshwater offshore. And so there's just, as we express the uncertainties, that's one of those things where there is a reservoir of freshwater that extends offshore as well, so that it takes some time to come in. We're watching our sentinel wells near the coastline so that we have a considerable amount of time between when, if we see this happening, and when it will approach production wells within the management area. So we have, I would say that by the time, if we were to see it at the coastline, and what the distance from Highway 1 to the coastline, it's probably several thousand feet at least, you have a considerable amount of time before we would notice it in a production well, longshore.
So what's your best guess? I mean, your ballpark? I mean, a couple of years? When the canary sings, how long do we have before we have to get supplemental water?
It'll probably be several years, yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Great question. Oh, someone else want to comment on that? Multiple panelists may want to comment on these questions, so bear with us as we...
Yeah, just to sort of follow up on your question.
Go
Thank you very much. Just to follow up on your question, that have you looked at the Northern Cities annual reports for 2009 and 2010?
personally? No.
Yeah, I encourage you to collect a copy and read it. They have very good descriptions of what they observed in 2009 and then confirming it again in 2010. And it certainly answers a lot of this that you spoke about. And while we address MMA, they address NCMA, Northern Cities Management Areas. And it's really important for these topics to look and read at what they have reported, because I think it's directly pertinent to your question.
Yes, please, your name.
Dan Wilson, Nakomo. My question, the past year was a great water year. Do the April 2011 key well readings indicate an increase in the key well index? And if so, how much change?
That's a good question. I think I can answer that one. Of course, we're always looking back a year to 2010, but we don't mind, I suppose, taking a little preview of 2011. We have looked at spring water levels. That information is available. It's just not in our report yet. It will be next April, May when you see it. But it's been a bit of a decline in the key well index, in spite of the good rainfall year. I didn't bring that quantity as half a foot or something like that. It's a fairly small, but it is a decline. And you'll see that reported in our 2011 annual report.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Bruce Severance. I'm from the rural water area as well. You just mentioned there was a half-foot decline despite a fairly heavy rainfall year. Is that a trend, or is that a new trend, or does that reflect the type of trends we may have seen in the past when we had heavy rainfall? In other words, in past years when there's heavy rainfall, do you normally see a 2-foot increase, and you didn't see it this time? And if so, do you have any scientific explanation for that? That's question number one, if I'm allowed two questions, I would love to ask a second question.
Your first question. Yes.
Go ahead.
We'd like some panelists to address this one, but we do have some other years, particularly the one around, it's hard to read this backwards, but 1992? Where we had a somewhat similar condition, where we had long-term drought, we did have some increased rainfall, and we did have a decline followed by a steady recovery. So it's too early to call it a trend. It's something that we're concerned about, I mean, certainly. And so we'll be watching it carefully as we get. We should have fall readings very soon here. In the next spring, if we have another decent rainfall year, we'll be looking for a similar pattern. If we don't see it, that will be certainly a concern. Is there others who want to speak to that?
Just for clarification, so what you're saying is normally it takes more time than has lapsed in order for that water to really percolate into the water table so that you could see a bounce back. You wouldn't see the bounce back until another 6 months have gone by.
Correct. We have some areas that have seen increased water levels, some of them significantly increased because of our wet year, and others that have not. So,
but the average has gone down.
The average has gone down.
Okay.
Down.
All right. But you're expecting maybe the bounce back hasn't quite happened yet.
Yeah, and I wouldn't quite label that an expectation. We're watching it. We see that something similar did happen, but conditions are a little different now. So there's.
Right. I mean, it will be interesting to see that. So my next question has to do with the slide where you showed a map of the Mesa and the two consecutive years. You had two different slides and or two different seasons, and you showed the depression in brown. Yeah. Now, is that a depression up near the northernmost point of the Mesa, or is that outside your area? You didn't really talk about the changes in water pressures at the north end of the map. Is that another depression there? And if so, is it out of your jurisdiction and that's why you didn't talk about it? Or is that right in the middle of where rural water is taking its water?
No, it is outside our management area from the northern cities area. And
okay.
It is a pumping depression. We did talk about it briefly in our annual report, but we generally don't report extensively on other management areas. But that's a good guess. I mean,
do you know, is that like in the agricultural area below the mesa there? Is that where that water depression is?
Can't you know if that's clustered around certain wells?
Well, yeah, it's about where...
It's located just below the Pomo Hill there where the valley comes into the mesa, where the valley road comes up.
Where valley intersects with Highway 1, so
yeah.
Hayashi's land. Okay. All right. Just wondering, and is that a significant depression? I mean, is that worse or not as severe as the one that seems to be closer to where Woodlands and Black Lake are?
Well, that area up there is in the Northern Cities Management Area, and we're talking to them about what if this is a real significant cone of depression.
So the topic of discussion, and this is a seasonal representation, so this is what it did in midsummer, is that correct?
October.
Fall, October, okay. All right, thank you.
Great.
Yes, my name is Bill Petrie. I'm a Napomo resident, and I attend a lot of these meetings, and I'd like to congratulate and thank the technical group, because I think everybody in the Mesa should be aware that they really are protecting us from, you know, surprises in our water supply. So given that, now I'll ask you a leading question. In your recommendation, you recommended, I think it was finding number one, or recommendation number one, that you recommend a supplemental water project be implemented as soon as possible. But then if you look in the report, all through the analysis sections and the data, there's no data to support that recommendation. It just shows up again in the section 9, which is the technical recommendations. So, to your knowledge, is there any technical report that shows any benefit from transporting water over ground from one area of the basin to another instead of just letting it flow normally underground? And then conversely, can you say that there's no adverse effect, side effects, by allowing this overground flow path?
Thanks, Bill. There is a section in our report where we provide just slightly more than what I mentioned here tonight. I hate to read to you, but I'm going to read to you. And this is on the supplemental water supply from our last report. It says an additional water supply that would allow reduced pumping within the NMMA is likely to be the most effective method of reducing the stress on the aquifer and allow the groundwater elevations to recover after that pumping compression. And the Pomo Supplemental Water Project is likely to be the fastest method of obtaining alternative water supplies. And given the potentially severe water shortage condition within the NMMA and other risk factors discussed in the report, the technical group recommends that the project be implemented as soon as possible. I just wanted to give everyone this. So we're all on the same page. In terms of your direct question, you certainly, if you look at our, let's go back. If you look at the positioning of our basin relative to, say, the main Santa Maria Basin, you can see just without much looking that we're quite westerly, you know, we're near the coast. I can tell you that one of the things that I've heard this comment from a number of different folks in our service area too. When is the technical group going to give us more than just a statement? When is it going to give us more background into why you made that statement? And that's something that the technical group is interested. We've received enough of that public feedback that we're intending to undertake that and maybe give you some more food for thought, some more documentation as to why we've reached that conclusion. We haven't formulated that yet. Expect to have that pretty soon here because it is a topic we're hearing a lot about. Folks may want to discuss the whole idea of pumping ships from west to east and that sort of thing. where you produce your water. But I guess the bottom line answer is we've heard that message from a couple of folks and feel like it's our mandate to do a little more work on that that we can release to the public than what we have so far.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to speak to that?
Hi, I'm Ed Eby. I'm a member of the NCSB Board of Directors. I have a question, but first I wanted a clarification. You said that the Key Well Index dropped from 2010 to 2011. I didn't hear you say how much it dropped in terms of feet.
Maybe I could have Brad speak to that. Do you remember the actual numeric value of that?
I do. It was 29.3 in 2010, in the spring of 2010, and the current calculation of the Key Well Index in spring of 2011 is 25.3. It dropped 4 points.
Thank you.
Thank you. My question is more of a question that a topic that you really didn't cover, and that was, is can you compare the conditions that led to seawater intrusion in Los Osos and Oceano with the conditions that exist around the Napomo Mesa, similarities and differences in the conditions?
I think so. Sam, you're probably more familiar with Los Osos than anyone.
Every place is a little bit different, but these are basins which have multiple aquifer intervals. And for instance, in the Los Osos area, you see that the deep and up in Salinas, where they have seawater intrusion, the deeper zones tended to have the more rapid intrusion, whereas the shallower ones were less prone to that because of the pressures that are generated by dense water at greater depths, and also by where people are pumping. And so if you want to compare the two, they both have their own identities. You don't have separate aquifers that people are pumping at in different amounts. And so we can speak in generalities, as we've done already, but to say that there's a specific comparison, it would be difficult to do because the pumping is different. One of the things that my opinion in terms of how the seawater intrusion can be occurring within this particular basin from the North Cities area to the Santa Maria Valley area is that where the aquifers tend to get shallower and pumping occurs along the coastline, the seawater intrusion is more, has a greater, is going to be noticed quicker, let's put it that way. And that's probably what they were seeing in the North Cities area, because the aquifers are not as deep as in the more central portions of the basin area, which include the coastal portions of the Napomo Mesa management area.
There is a technical document on the Los Osos seawater intrusion. We were able to get about $250,000 of grant funds there. Great document, seawater intrusion study that talks about how fast it marched in and so forth. For those of you interested, again, give me your name and your email and I can get that in your hands just so you can see a comparison. Because in Los Osos we saw groundwater levels drop near the coast. We saw sentinel wells begin to detect seawater intrusion. We saw it march in. And we tracked it over time when we did the study, so more information on that if you're interested.
Next. My name is Mike Gwynn. I'm the director of the NCSD, born and raised in this county. You're looking at the early onset of seawater intrusion in Oceano, and as you said, it's pretty minimal right now. How would that compare to what's happened in Los Osos? And Mr. Cleep, I know, has looked at this for many years. Have they ever recovered any land seawater took over? Have those wells ever been recovered?
Well, in Los Osos area, the seawater intrusion still is occurring. When we speak speak about areas where the waters have recovered, you can look in some of these coastal basins, like, for instance, Morro Creek Valley, Pico Creek Valley. There are some shallow valley alluvial deposits where we see the seawater being pushed back out, and so that you see some recovery in those. And the deeper basins, like for instance the Oxnard Plain or the Salinas Basin, you can see that they have improved the situations, even in the Orange County and LA basins. They've been able to manage their seawater intrusion issues. But it takes some time to do that once this happens. And so there are certain chemical changes that happen as seawater intrusion occurs, especially when you have water flowing where the water reacts with the soil underground somewhat. So you have some ion exchange that happen. So that certain parameters like chlorides and sodium, which are very, very mobile, they can be pushed back out. But so there's some of the other specific ions take more time to reverse the effects.
I think I think one more point about Los Osos is that currently Los Osos needs to have another source of water to be able to back off on those wells. You find yourself in a situation where you're trying to meet demands, and they have an upper basin that has nitrates in it and a lower basin that has seawater intrusion. And so they've not been able to push that intrusion out because they simply don't have the water to deliver to the customers so they can turn down those wells to the point that it will improve. There's another Corps mandated group there that is working on those issues. There are options, but they're not quick to implement.
My name is Jim Toomey. I'm a resident of Pomo. One of your slides depicted the fact that you intended to measure stream flow on the Pomo Mesa management area. Other than Black Lake Canyon, there's, to my knowledge, no live streams. So I assume you're measuring either the Pomo Creek and the Los Verdes Creek. How significant is the recharge from those sources to the MMA?
Everyone lit up when you asked that question. That was my favorite question.
It's a part of the water balance we've not been able to quantify because there are inadequate gauging stations along the Pomo Creek, for instance. Los Verdes does have gauging stations and some historical data. But the question is really, how much of the water supply does water that is derived from outside of the area that flows down those creeks and then potentially percolates into the aquifers underneath the home? We are beginning to look at that. It's a challenging technical question because it requires not only good data, but also requires a good understanding of the interface between the channel itself and the aquifer at depth. And there's some work done currently where we're evaluating the hydrogeological cross-sections along the borders of Los Verdes. We've not been able to accomplish those tasks along the Pomo Creek. But in the largest picture, in the sense, it may be a significant component. We just don't know at this point, and it is on our recommendation list. And we will continue to push towards those greater understandings. And again, a lot of this is prioritizing what we think with our available resource we can accomplish on a year-to-year basis. And we continue to implement our understanding into that annual report and build upon in the following years. At best I can say, look forward to the future.
Ingmar Loringson, Ag User Hand Residential. Definition of shallow water basin and deep water basin, and also on monitoring ocean water level, is that stable? Is that something also monitored?
Yeah. definition of shallow versus deep tend to give some depth. I mean, it depends on where your land is, but give us some.
There is a sand, the sand dunes that compose the Nipomo Mesa throughout it extend a couple hundred feet down below ground. In some areas it goes, as you get closer to the coast, the contact of the base of that sand gets deeper. And within those upper sands, the water generally flows under unconfined conditions. And that would be the shallow aquifer. The deeper aquifers, there's more clays and gravels, and then even some deeper sands below that. And those are under pressure. And generally, the water levels in the shallow aquifers are higher and less variable than the water in the deeper zones. And so there's, even within the basin, different layers where you have different pressures on the water, and they're very different in terms of their aquifer characteristics. So you'll see if your well is 200 to 300 feet deep, we would consider that a shallow well in general.
Hello, my name is John Snyder from Nipomo.
Oh, John, I'm really sorry. We didn't ask the second question.
Oh.
Sea level. Are we monitoring sea level averages?
That's fine, go ahead.
It's not a formal parameter that we're monitoring right now. In other basins, and specifically, there's been some sensitivity analysis done for climate change, but that's not been undertaken by the technical group. Sorry, John. Go.
That's okay. All right, it's me again. John Snyder. I have a number of questions. First of all, monitoring along the coast is very important, I think. Three of the 10 monitoring wells that were originally along the coast were lost. One of those is the Osa Flacco. If you go to Bing, which is available to everybody, and zoom in on that puppy there, there's new imagery available. I know you had said that it was under 20 or 30 feet of sand. I'm thinking more like 10 or 8 feet. And so I wonder what you've actually done to take a look at that data. And if you're not looking at it, well, where's the replacement? What's the cost and the schedule on that? And I heard at the beginning of this meeting that there was an additional well that was punched somewhere. It'd be nice if somebody could point out where it might be on your, you had a map of monitoring wells. Could we?
Well, why don't we let us take these one at a time?
Okay. Monitoring wells, that's the question.
Let's get the key. Tim, can you ID on this? Where the new well is, push the red button and see if it comes to the back side. I don't know if people
can see it.
Can you see it?
Yeah. Okay.
There's a new well that was drilled this year at Illinois and Eucalyptus.
Okay.
So, and that's to replace a well that has been discontinued in the county monitoring program adjacent to that. There's also a new one. Let's see, where am I again? up in the area, am I in the right area here?
Up higher. Brad, you got it.
No. There's another well that's just at the base of the mesa on the north side, on Halcyon.
Okay.
Okay, so
right, it goes down the...
Right, at the bottom of the hill. And so we have, those are two, the county has paid for and put in, and they're surveying them in, and they're going to be dedicated monitoring wells. So they're going to give us really good information.
I mean, speaking to Osa Flacco real briefly, I mean, a number of people at this table have attempted to meet the county and talking to people. So the free dinner for whoever finds that well, if you can show us the spot, I mean, 8 feet, I'd be tempted to dig myself. Yeah. We do have an endangered species issue there, so you got to be careful when you access those areas. Yeah. But so far, we've not been able to come up with a location.
You know, one of the things also that I believe would be helpful is if we were able to put in monitoring wells closer to the coast.
Right.
And there's a bathroom facility in the Oso Flaco area that's kind of in that interdunal area that is accessible, where monitoring wells could be put in that would probably be much, much more sensitive to onshore movement of any seawater intrusion.
Yeah.
And that's where we're thinking that would be a really helpful place to do it.
And we put $130,000 into our long-term plan to be funded over a number of years. Although the bid we got back from the recent monitoring well was very good, and would actually reduce that cost somewhat. If, you know, we can get a good.
Yeah, I think
I can throw it.
I think the counties are doing an excellent job of developing these new dedicated monitoring wells, and they have more plans to do that in the future. So that's going to be a great help for us.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Thanks. And we're putting the pressure, you know, on the county to do whatever they can do whenever we can. Many pictures provided by NTSC sort of misrepresent the seawater interface by showing it, you know, essentially right where the waves of the beach are, and then coming in under the mesa. I noticed you've shown the picture that shows that it goes offshore, and I'm sure you're aware of the 1979 study by the DWR that tried to quantify the amount of water offshore. In that study, they just roughly estimated that a quarter of that water would be usable, and it might be 1.5 million acre feet out there. And so the question would be, first of all, what has the technical group done to assure that we've used this free supply of water to its fullest extent before paying Santa Maria a profit for bringing water up here? And secondly, have you done any work on a time and a cost estimate to essentially drill a horizontal well out to figure out where that really is? I mean, because it makes a big difference whether it's, you know, a quarter mile offshore or 5 miles offshore. And while I was sitting here, it could occur to me, if you actually hit seawater with that monitoring well, you could just peel the label monitoring off of it and stick the desal intake and save us all a lot of money.
All right. Well, those are a couple of questions there. I think the first one was, has the technical group done any work to characterize how much additional water we may be able to pump that's currently moving toward the ocean? And that's a question that we would love to be able to stand up in front of you and say, here's how much you can pump, here's how much is moving out to the ocean, and you can safely produce this much, this will support this much development and so forth. But we call that the safe yield of a basin. I don't know if you've heard this term before, but it's basically the amount that you can safely pump without creating an adverse condition like seawater intrusion. And that's not a number that we have. That is the goal of this group, is to understand enough about this complex geology to produce that number. But we're definitely not there yet. May not be there until we have a functioning water model. And what those of us took, it took a water model to get there, to get that number, and then to have it be defensible. And even then, it's refined year after year as more information comes in. So that's a very important thing to walk away with, an understanding that this technical group's not saying, not giving an absolute number as far as safe yield of this basin at this point. It's absolutely our goal to do something. And then there was another question about a horizontal well.
I think one thing that's important to remember in this is that the geology of that offshore area that you're talking about is not well understood, not by us or by others. So one possibility is that these aquifers that we utilize onshore extend in kind of a tabular wave take fashion for some distance offshore. But that's one of many possibilities. As you know, there's a lot of other structure in this area. You saw the example cross-section that Rob brought up. What we know from the onshore area, and it's quite complicated indeed. And so there's certainly also the possibility offshore geology is quite complicated. It may be disrupted by faults. There may be changes in the sediments themselves from the depositional environment that they were in. And so there's no simple way to answer the question that you're asking. I'm sorry to say.
Okay. I appreciate that answer. I believe it is a complicated question. That's why I was suggesting maybe it'd be economical to drill out there and get more information. The Woodlands project in the part of the EIR process had a series of monitoring studies that were done. The last one of those I have is from 2007. I was curious whether that series has continued past the kind of the 2007-2008 time horizon.
Yeah, it does, kind of annually.
It's still in
We see wastewater report of groundwater conditions downstream of wastewater discharges and a water level report that is updated annually. It's not filed with the county.
I was just curious whether it was continued. You got the man right there. And my next question is, sometimes we hear about confined aquifers and semi-confined aquifers and unconfined aquifers east and west of the maybe the Oceano Fault. When you go and you look at the picture of the water level contours, those essentially are, I believe, depicted for an unconfined aquifer where the water is essentially at the level of the wells, whereas it would seem to me if you had a confined aquifer, you're actually not looking at so much a change in volume, but a change in pressure. And so it affects your potential calculation of the amount of water in storage, which then feeds back at how much water we have and how much water we can use. Are we confined or unconfined? We have some pretty high numbers of change in storage from Mr. Newton that assumes that it's unconfined. And this graph, to me, would seem to depict that it's unconfined. But then they also wanted to put the sewage effluent water in my backyard because it wouldn't percolate in west of me because it was confined. So I'm curious what the confinement is.
Okay, well, why don't we
how it affects water and storage calculations.
Pretty well, I'm going to take that in two steps. First, these contours, do these imply confinement or unconfinement? And then we'll discuss our understanding of confinement. So first are the contours.
The contours are created from data values of water level at a place, a monitoring well that's measured by the county. One way to think of that is that it is the pressure surface for water within that screened interval that monitoring well is screened in. And whether it's confined or unconfined is another matter. The potentiometric surface measured by the water level at that place is true and real. These contours simply contour that data. And so the question is an interesting one. The contours as presented are real based upon that pressure surface and represent truly the pressure surface between those points from that monitoring time period. A separate question is what is the hydrogeology under the land that is controlling water flow or the conditions in which water exists, whether it's unconfined or confined. And that's a separate question.
Okay, and just to maybe augment that, so you could literally have half of this picture confined, half of it unconfined, and you wouldn't be able to tell one way or another by looking at these contours, correct?
Yes, but more importantly, the contours are correct, irrespective of whether it's confined or
unconfined. Totally understand.
And that, I think, is the more pertinent part of your question, I believe, if I'm correct, is that the contours are a true representation. There's nothing incorrect.
Of the pressure, but not of the volume.
of the potentiometric surface
pressure. Right, the pressure. Now, the second part of the question, if you look at our annual reports and the calculations that we make and don't make, we aren't in these reports making volume calculations, volume storage calculations. We're just not there yet as a technical group, as a consensus group. And we do hope to get there as we begin to understand all the ins and outs of what happens in our basin. But at this point, we're not reporting those values as a technical group.
Okay, thank you. My comment on that would be that we have some of the members independently reporting the volume of water. And if we're losing 27,000 acre feet in a 6-month period, it doesn't seem to make much sense to bring in 3,000 acre feet a year until we really know what's going on. But I'll move on. As most people know, I don't think the Sanary really has the legal right to sell the water they're selling, and therefore I don't think that's a legitimate supply and not very reliable. Some of the alternatives are, and it's been mentioned here briefly, to relocate the pumping, which I think would be more feasible and faster. NCSD has a couple of well sites along the river, maybe around that 70 contour, and one at Bonita School Road. There's some confidential information analyzing the ability to pump in those areas. And I'm wondering whether you have access to that. And I'm also wondering, there was talk at another meeting about an attorney letter that may or may not be confidential from Oceana that has more information on the monitoring well up there, whether you have access to that. And then I'll just throw in my last question here so you can get them all. We went down to the TMA meeting, which is the group to the south, and there's, according to them, if I just kind of paraphrase it, there's a kind of a collision in the contours that don't match up, spring and fall, or early spring and late spring readings that don't match up, some of you with this new monitoring well you're drilling. Can you tell us a little bit about the TMA analysis and how it fits in with your analysis on the contours? And relative to the, you know, let's just put two more wells in more to the south and save ourselves some money so we can afford some diesel plant. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Sean. I think we've got really three main questions. The first is on shift and pumping. One of the things that we do have is this well management plan. You'll see it in the appendix to our annual report, I believe. And that's something that this year we have a goal to further refine that plan. We do have some water interties between some of these purveyors, Golden State NCSD, NCSD the Woodlands. So the idea of strategic pumping is an idea that we're definitely talking about, and we look to refine that plan this year. Certainly if water levels continue to decline, that would be from a very important management strategy. As far as the wells around the 70 contour, I don't have the information on those. And our group hasn't discussed those as a group. The other question was on Oceano. I don't know the letter that's being referred to. Be interested. As long as it's not a closed session letter. The TMA meeting, the matchup of contours, and the time period where these water levels are taken. Who wants to grab that one? Brad, if you can go on that.
Yes, this is a good observation, John. It's been quite a discussion we've had with the various parties' management areas for a couple of years, particularly amongst the consultants preparing the annual report. The problem most basically arises from the San Luis Obispo County monitoring program that is conducted by their staff versus the monitoring that is conducted in Santa Barbara County and by their staff. And they're done on two different time periods. And so you get data in Santa Barbara County collected at a different month than the data in San Luis Obispo County that's being collected during the springtime. And because the aquifer is responding due to local rainfall at that time in the winter, there could be differences within a month in water levels. And that has a big impact on how those contours marry or don't marry. We've talked a lot about how we could possibly resolve that. You probably can appreciate what it might be to ask a county to change the monitoring program. Things of this nature, though, are being considered. One thing that would certainly help that we recognize is if we implement automated transducers in specific key wells that collect data on a weekly basis and store it in a data logger, which can be downloaded. This would resolve all of these issues of timing and would help our process of understanding across those management area boundaries greatly. But thanks for pointing that out. That is a very important point.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And just to augment that, it'd be very tough for either county to sort of yield to the other, since they might have decades worth of historical data. They'd be loath to change their monitoring because then that historical data wouldn't be a match. So, other questions?
My name is Pat Eby and I live in the Palm. NCSG claims that the mesa's running out of water and cites the cause as overpumping due to urban growth. NCSG has used data in their presentations to the community and in the newspaper from the TG annual report to support their contention. Does the TG agree with this position? And if so, why is there no such statement in the annual report? If not, it appears that a member of your group is making statements that do not truly reflect your group's opinion. And I'd like to know why, because it does diminish the credibility of your group's work to cite you incorrectly. That's one question, and I have another. Has NNMA evaluated any water conservation methods to determine their effectiveness on returning water to the basin? And Rob, you and I have had a discussion about the retention basins at Woodlands, and you stated that you thought on an average rainfall year, they returned about 200 acre feet of water to the basin. Well, if other retention basins, if there was a study done to see how much water is returned to the basin from retention basins, that might be a very great incentive to build more, and we may not need supplemental water if we can return enough water to the basins in conservation measures. So I would think that would be, I realize you probably are overburdened with work already, but really we need to move forward instead of just always looking at what's happened in the past. So I'd just like you to comment on that. And the third comment I have is I have read the Northern Cities Technical Reports both years. I did not see in this past year, it definitely stated there was no evidence of seawater intrusion in any of the Northern Cities wells anywhere. So, and a further comment I wanted to make is on the well levels. Mr. Newton, I believe you did a separate report on the well levels for NCSD. I didn't have it with me tonight, but I believe the date is June 11, 2011, that shows water levels were increased from 8,000 acre feet to 8,700 acre feet from last spring 2010 to 2011. Now, maybe you did a different time frame, and I know you did 40 or 50 well levels instead of 8. So would that be an indication that, well, maybe you had shallower wells and were responding to the rainfall faster, and so we just need to wait a little bit of time to see the improvement? Thank you.
Thanks, Pat. If I butcher or forget your question, you can restate it. But I think with response to your first question, you know, are we running out of water? How is the technical group making statements to that effect? I think it's very important for people to realize that when this technical group meets and decides on language in a document, any member of the group has veto power, so it's
very consensus building by its nature. It takes a long time to do things, but when we do say something, it's by consensus. So some of the statements, even if you read the executive summary, if that's all you can get through, you know, we do make statements about trends in water levels after their decline and our relative concern about that. So, for instance, in the executive summary, we say there's no evidence of any water quality issues, including seawater intrusion, that significantly restrict current use of groundwater. But in other places, we talk about lowering water levels and a concern over the ability of the aquifer to replenish those pumping holes. So we, without having a firm safe yield number that you can compare your pumping to, we try to make our statements as accurate as we can. They may not satisfy people, but we feel like we just can't say much else until we have consensus with the technical information. So we try to let the statement stand. Now, each of the technical group members do independent technical work and may make statements and representations that aren't necessarily reviewed by this group, and we're free to do that. We do ask folks to characterize that as not something that's been reviewed by the technical group, but each of these experts here is doing their own independent technical work for their different clients. Stormwater basins. Early on, we focused on the same thing. Where is the drainage master plan that takes it in the bay and defines where the stormwater is going? We know we have basins here and there. There's a lot of them. But is there water actually leaving our area? Can we capture some of that water? That document today doesn't exist. There are drainage documents that talk about flooding and that sort of thing, but not really from a groundwater perspective. So that work definitely needs to be done. It's not done. This is one reason why, in the pursuit of grant funds, you can go so much farther with a single, good, solid grant. It takes you years to get there so that you can put one person on these questions and have them on until it gets done. So you're right, Pat. That's a very important question for stormwater, the fate of stormwater on the Mesa. As far as the NCMA report, I know that folks report year to year, so when you see a statement in the report, and I hope others can clarify this, that there's no evidence of seawater intrusion, that's, every statement that's made is generally a snapshot for the previous year that it's reporting on. So if they had a good water year, they pushed seawater out and all their monitoring wells are healthy, and they make that statement, no evidence of seawater intrusion. Previous annual report the year before, they may say, well, we had a hit this year, so they may not go report to report. Does that ring true with some folks here? Okay. And then, well levels, that last question, hoping somebody else can tackle that one. Not going to do it justice. Patty, maybe to help me out on that last question. You got that, Brad?
Is this the question you asked specifically of me?
Yeah.
Yes. If I can summarize the question, it was our QO index for spring of 2011 has dropped, and that is not the same index as what the report I presented to the board of directors for NCSD at one of their board meetings, which is a different index. And you're absolutely correct in your understanding. The index that is prepared for the board, it takes into account many more wells than 8, which is included in the key well index. And you sort of hinted at perhaps a process which may be represented in those two different data, that water flows and that there's a timing issue. We have discussed that amongst the technical group that what is the nature of which rainfall recharges the aquifer and how the timing of rainfall affects the water that's collected on a particular day. And it's certainly a point of interest for us. It gets into that part of understanding the hydrogeology under the mesa, which could be characterized in a groundwater model. we're not at a place, and I think I can speak for everybody, and correct me if you guys think differently, but I think we're not at a place to where we understand the process of water flow in Indonesia well enough to be able to explain why water shows up in one well at what time. But we're headed towards that. And we're certainly developing our understanding and knowledge of the hydrogeology as fast as we can.
Karen?
Okay. I'm just a newcomer to all of this, but I just put this thing in the statement, Oceana. In August 2009, seawater intrusion was found 1/2 mile inland, just 1 mile from the municipal freshwater well. Is that a true statement? Was that seawater intrusion, or was that a bad well management? Was it a bad casing, or what? Can you explain that statement?
Who wants to take a shot at that one? Tim? Want to go first? Well, I mean, we have to be, just to be fair to our Northern City's neighbors, you know, their technical group goes to a level of detail on their area that we don't, so we're always careful not to stomp all over their toes because they know more than we do about their area. But we can report on what we've heard, what we're reading in their annual reports. What was that?
Before you start, can I just read this?
Just read it, yeah. Which report is that from?
Let me just read this for you because I think, for me anyway, it's helpful. This comes out of the 2009 annual monitoring for Northern Cities Management Area. Okay, for 2009. It was released April of 2010, reflective of the year of 2009. And one of the reasons why we want to refer to this report is because we don't want to be in the position of interpreting their data or work, that's their job, but I'd love to just read this for you, if you let me. It's on page 12. It's the last part of paragraph 4. And I'll start. Seven samples from 32S, 13E, 30M, these are wells that are at the coast, central monitoring wells, showed signatures more similar to seawater in the spring, summer, and fall 2009. In January 2010, the signatures for the 30N wells, especially 30N02, which is a specific depth at that well, changed again to a signature more similar to groundwater base. The oscillation between seawater and groundwater signatures indicates that the interface between seawater and fresh groundwater is shifting with probable mixing at this location. End of paragraph. From a technical position, what that says is that they observe seawater.
That's okay. Yep. I'll go with that. Further questions? I know that you're going to leave and wish you had asked that question. There you go.
My name is Jerry Smith, and I live in the Pomo, and I'm also new to this discussion. It seems to me that just as a suggestion that a ring overlay map of some type would be very beneficial with your nice chart that you have that goes back to 1975 to at least show us some relationship. I noticed in 1 year, for example, you had a 50% increase in the number from 28 or so to 42, which is substantial, especially if there were drought years before. So I'm not sure how all that relates, but it also brings to mind that information should be available from the National Weather Bureau so we can be able to overlay that particular map. The second thing, that was a suggestion, not a question. I hear and see the shape of the area that this technical group is confined to, I would say, looking at the entire aquifer, and it's sort of, and I don't mean to belittle the work that you've done, but it sort of reminds me of having an engineering group work on an airplane engine, and the rest of the airplane is sitting over here. And it certainly does lead one to wonder where is the unifying factor is essentially when I see this little area of aquifer that you guys are responsible for, and then I hear all these other misreports. They take their data from an earlier month, a later month, and they're more technical here and so forth. It sort of leads one to believe that maybe somebody ought to go back to the court and really redefine what is going on with relationship to whose responsibility everything is for this entire aquifer, instead of concentrating, if you will, on the engine and worrying about the wings falling off of the airplane. The other thing that I would like to ask the question is, it seems that I don't know how much money, I hear these numbers thrown around, $30 million for this and that and the other and so forth. And I don't know how much a desalination plant costs. I don't know what those numbers are. But also I see driving up through the areas of the severe depression where the these cones are on your contour maps, and it seems to me if you're going to spend $30 million, that maybe somebody ought to at least throw out the idea of perhaps buying the Hiachi land for the $30 million and at least putting that back into the aquifer and just letting it be a natural land. Are you investigating other things other than just running a pipeline?
Those are important questions, Jerry. I like the airplane analogy. You may hear that next year. Write that one down. I think every one of these panelists have felt the same thing, and there's a frustration level to it. But in order to overcome that, we've reached out to our neighboring technical experts in the Northern Cities and the Santa Maria, and we're meeting together. I mean, even in those early meetings, you know, it's a little bit difficult because the non-technical people want to go and say, no, we'll keep this just for the technical people so we can speak freely, share information, compare data, and that's happening, and it's happening with some regularity. And in fact, we're looking to jointly pursue grants, jointly pursue studies, because it is one basin, and that's what makes sense. So I think you're going to see a convergence over time of those groups speaking with a more and more united voice. Now, we are court-mandated separate groups, and maybe someday they do get combined, although the lawyers think about that, but the technical people are collaborating, and they are comparing notes to come up with more unified conclusions. Feel free to augment anybody here. As far as looking at water supply alternatives, you know, our charge is to look at the health of the basin and to say, you need to get supplemental water, or you need to pump less from the west side of the aquifer, or things like that, general statements. And it falls to the purveyors, the individual members of this party, to pursue those projects and alternatives. It's not part of our court mandate to do that. In fact, we're really careful not to go beyond that, so we can stay objective as much as we possibly can. So you'll see our statements stop at things like, do a supplemental project, do it now. We pretty much stay within that confinement. Very good. We're not required to do public meetings, but every year we get reminded of why we need to do them. That people come and ask great questions. Every single person is civil. We have a very high level of discussion. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your Thursday night to do this. It means a lot to us. And we'll be hanging around, available for other personal questions. Or if you need any of these documents, please get us that email address, and we'll send them to you. Thank you very much. Thank you.